Hey everybody, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton and this is the Weekend Interview Show every Saturday here on the Limited Temporary Constitutional Republic Broadcasting Network every Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. Texas time. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com if you'd like to check out the archives of any of the previous interviews. And our guest today is Joseph Sobrin. He's the former senior editor of National Review. He now writes columns for the Griffin Internet Syndicate, his own monthly newsletter, Sobrin's, and the Catholic weekly, The Wanderer. He's the author of the books Single Issues, Essays on the Crucial Social Questions. Anything called a program is unconstitutional, Confessions of a Reactionary Utopian. Alias Shakespeare, Solving the Greatest Literary Mystery of All Time, and Hustler, The Clinton Legacy. You can read what he writes at Sobrin.com. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Scott. Nice to be here.
Well, it's very nice to have you on. I was reading through some of your old articles recently, and I noticed that you've written that the American people have been lied into every war since the invasion of Mexico in 1846. How do you back that up?
Well, James Polk said the Mexicans had attacked U.S. forces, which is very doubtful. And when the young congressman, Abraham Lincoln, called him on it, demanded to know the precise spot where it had happened, where this alleged attack had happened, Polk simply ignored him. Lincoln was nicknamed Spotty Lincoln and lost, couldn't even run again for his congressional seat. Well, Lincoln unfortunately learned the wrong lesson from that. He learned that a president in wartime can get away with nearly everything. So, he threw the Constitution out pretty much when the South tried to secede. And his reasoning on why no state could secede was pretty feeble. And so it has gone. All the way to, I can't give you details for the Spanish-American War, but I suspect it was pretty much the same as were World Wars I and II.
Yeah, we do seem to have, as you pointed out in the article that I'm referring to, it's always forced on us, supposedly, by some dubious event, the sinking of the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, the battleship Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin battle, supposedly. There's always this event that, quote-unquote, forces the war upon America.
Right, yeah, and everybody gets hot-headed, and we've got to defend the country. We're told that our freedom is in danger. Lincoln said that if the South seceded, freedom would perish from the earth. From the earth! My gosh. I mean, people don't, even now, they don't go back and read these words with their cool judgment. They just take them at face value. It's terrible.
Yeah, and the suppression of the insurrection in the Philippines, I often think back about, I don't know whole lot about that, but I know that the Spanish finally didn't own the Philippines anymore, and they thought, yay, we're free, and then they looked at the horizon and saw a battleship with the red, white, and blue on it.
Right.
And, oh, here we go all over again.
Yeah. That's tragic.
Yeah, they needed uplifting and Christianizing, right?
As somebody said, the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history.
Oh, and then we just repeat it all over again.
Right.
Well, I don't really want to ask this next question until we get back from the break, which, we don't really have time. But when we come back, I'm going to ask you, how do you ever follow in with the National Review crowd? It's Joe Sobrin on the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, your host, and our guest this hour is Joseph Sobrin. He's the former editor of National Review, and that's kind of puzzling because when I read your articles, it seems like you're a pretty rational guy. I wonder how you could have ever fallen in with William F. Buckley and all those sick warmongers over at National Review.
Well, you have to remember, back in the 60s, the conservative movement was still taking shape. And National Review's conservatism and Bill Buckley's seemed like a very attractive alternative to the kind of liberalism we were groaning under. He was anti-liberal, anti-communist, and besides that, a very smart and charming man. Wonderful guy. I mean, I'm still fond of the memory, though not of his ideas. So I hooked up there and started writing for him in 72. I was only a senior editor, not the editor. That was always Bill's position.
I see.
But by about 1990, I was very uneasy because it seemed to me that National Review was not really devoted to sound conservative principles, that it was always supporting any war the U.S. got into. And I wondered if there was such thing as a war it wouldn't support. So,
it's
about big government. I mean, the kind of military budgets we were supporting and demanding were, far, far bigger than necessary for any defense, especially after the Soviet Union collapsed.
I was going to say, I noticed you're saying 1991, 92, that's the time when the big excuse for conservative big government kind of came to an end. And I noticed, seems like many of the paleoconservatives, like Pat Buchanan and so forth, kind of supported the Cold War, but then when the Soviet Union was gone and NATO wasn't, they kind of said, hey, the promise was that all this big government was just temporary until the Soviet Union was gone.
Right.
And now here we're left with this giant Leviathan.
Right.
Is that basically what happened to you with the first Gulf War?
Exactly what happened. I wondered, why on earth were we invading Panama, for example? What threat did Panama pose to the U.S.? I just couldn't see it. And then came the first Gulf War, and I said, well, here it is. These guys are going to cheer on any war the U.S. gets into. I always say conservatives don't mind big government as long as it's shooting someone.
Right. Well, so when you look back on the Cold War years now, do you feel like, kind of too bad you weren't just a libertarian all along?
Yeah.
And that the Cold War was kind of phony as well?
Yes. And, I mean, when I think back on Vietnam, I really wish I'd joined the anti-war movement, although that was that tended to be too left-wing for me. They just wanted a different kind of big government. So I stuck with my crowd, but I really am sorry I ran with a pack like that as long as I did. I didn't even entertain the possibility of, other positions, libertarian, anarchist, whatever, something other than this kind of patriotism run amok. Not patriotic.
At what point did you start reading Rothbard?
Late 80s, I'd say. I'd always found him kind of shocking. And he is, in a healthy way. He rethought everything from the ground floor. He was a marvelous man and a great thinker, too.
I noticed in reading one of your articles about anarchy that you and I actually share the same story of how we got pushed from constitutionalist to anarchist, and that is Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Yep.
And I guess go ahead and tell your story, and I can pretty much just say ditto for me. That's what happened to me.
Well, in Hans Hoppe, Murray Rothbard got the disciple he deserved, and he, too, is had a great impact on the way I look at things in general. Now, he pointed out that in the 19th century, Russia, the U.S., Germany, and Italy are all consolidating into big, powerful states. And World War I followed. It's just one of those simple, large patterns you have to train yourself to notice. And Hans made me notice that one. Government has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And conservatism has abetted this, so-called conservatism. It squeaks a little bit about limited government, but when the chips are down, most conservatives have supported the growth of the state.
It seems like the real breaking point is when you realize Hoppe's assertion just seems so obvious that really there's no such thing as a limited republic, that if you create a constitutional government, it's basically becomes an unlimited democracy or an unlimited state of some description,
yeah, well,
constitution or not.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson explained exactly why. He said, if the federal government is allowed to be the sole final interpreter of the Constitution, you might as well throw it out, because the government will always interpret the Constitution in a way that enlarges its own powers. And that's exactly what we've seen over the centuries now. I mean, it's time to learn.
Mr. Sobrin, I've noticed that quite a few of the paleoconservatives and paleolibertarians, at least among the leadership, seem to be Catholics. You, Pat Buchanan, Lou Rockwell. And I wonder, is there a causation to that correlation?
I've often wondered that, but, you know, a lot of us are Jews and some Protestants and some atheists. You know, you just don't know, but it varies from case to case. But I've noticed a surprising number of Catholics becoming anarchists and libertarians lately, which gratifies me as a Catholic.
Well, it's very refreshing for someone for myself. I've never really been left or right. I've always kind of been a libertarian ever since I thought about these sorts of things.
You.
And so it's really nice to see a movement of, even if it has to change the name from conservatism to paleoconservatism, but to see an anti-war right wing, I think, is very important when,
right.
As you said before, the anti-war movement, if you look at it, it's a bunch of white kids with dreadlocks sitting blocking traffic when people are trying to get home from work, and nobody has any sympathy for them.
Right.
But Joseph Sobrin is the former senior editor of National Review, and, you know, we're going to have to at least take out a minute to understand why you're against all these wars.
Well, you know, war is killing people. I mean, I can't imagine Christ being a bomber pilot. You know, in fact, he never exhorts anyone to take any kind of political action. Anything. He suggests that the state is a dubious enterprise. And he says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. He doesn't tell you what things those are or if there are anything things that belong to Caesar, does he?
No.
Is that to you?
That's right. And, you know, the way I've always learned that, and I'm not a particularly religious guy myself, but the way I've always learned that story is the real lesson there is that none of this matters. This is just your test to see whether you get eternity or not.
Right.
And so if Caesar wants something from you, who cares? Go ahead and give it to him, because that's not what matters anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot different interpretation than, see here, Jesus says pay your taxes.
Right.
And show up at the conscription office when they ask you to.
Right. Well, you know, he didn't condemn those who worked for the state. He was, you know, charitable to the Roman centurion. He said he hadn't seen such faith in all Israel. So, you know, he doesn't always give us a direct teaching on these subjects. But, you know, nobody can claim him that way. So, we have to just kind of keep listening, I think.
What do you make of these Christian Zionists who seem to be more pro-Israel than any American Jews?
Yeah, I know it. That's a problem, isn't it?
I'm not really sure what their motivation is.
Well, I take them at their word. They really believe that God gave that land to the Jews forever. But why that should implicate the U.S. government is another matter.
Oh, you're not supposed to think about that, though. You're just supposed to go from step one to step three.
Yeah, right. So, seems to me, well, for one thing, there's the obvious indifference to the fate of Arab Christians, for example. What about them? Do they have any rights? Even if they've lived there for centuries?
Well, it seems like there's been negative consequences for the Christians that live in Iraq right now.
Yeah, sure.
I've read
how
stories.
Many...
Oh, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Well, just the... please call me Joe. And anyway, the... How many Iraqi deaths is an acceptable number to achieve whatever goal it is we're trying to achieve? They don't talk about that. I mean, some estimates have run up as high as 100,000 non-combatants killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq.
Right, the British Journal Lancet.
Huh?
The British Journal Lancet.
Yeah, that may be high, but obviously the number must be by now tens of thousands. Well, if we're supposed to be fighting this war, aren't we entitled to know the costs?
Hang on, we'll be right back with Joe Sobrin, the Weekend Interview Show. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest is Joe Sobrin. You can read what he writes at Sobrin.com. And, sir, when we were going to break, you were asking the question, what's the limit? There must be some cap on the number of Iraqi civilians that it's okay for us to kill before it's not okay anymore.
Or if not, let them say so. Let them say it's worth an infinite number of innocent deaths. You know, this is pretty hard for me to talk about, because it's just so awfully painful to ponder what the U.S. is doing. For example, early in the war, there was a story in the New Yorker about a little boy in Baghdad whose house was hit by an American rocket. It killed all six of his brothers and sisters, both his parents, and burned off both his arms, forearms. And it became a sensational story in Europe and the Arab world. But we've heard almost nothing about it here. And that's just too painful for words. And things like that are happening all the time. We ought to at least take an interest, shouldn't we?
It's funny about that story, Little Ali.
Yeah.
The only media I've ever seen about him here was just to celebrate what a gracious, wonderful country America is, that now we've given him some plastic arms.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he was adopted by a family in Canada, actually. But this poor child, oh my gosh. I got one angry email from some woman who said, I didn't care about this kid. Well, I didn't say I cared. I just said, here are the facts. Interested?
Yeah, do you care or not?
Yeah.
That's really the question, right,
yeah,
whether she
right.
cares.
Do you want your country to do this? Do you want to be known for this? Do you enjoy your reputation? That's what we've got now. We're the world's most hated country.
Well, Joe, as a former National Review conservative, surely you can put yourself in the mind frame of those who support this and say, well, but we're America, the benevolent liberators, and we've come to save these people from their dictatorship.
Oh, yeah, I used to think like that, or tried to. Didn't come off too well. I read some of the old right guys, like Garrett Garrett. You know of him? He wrote for the Saturday Evening Post in the 30s and 40s.
Sure. In fact, I'm reading a great book right now called Reclaiming the American Right by Justin Raimondo. That
oh, yeah.
Is all about Nock and Garrett Garrett, Mencken.
Good. Right. There was another American conservative tradition which has been almost entirely forgotten, and I would say deliberately obliterated by the National Review crowd, who are now basically just neoconservatives. The kids running that magazine now know very little about the history of conservatism. They couldn't even explain this to you, you see. But anyway, I painfully relearned what had been kind of poured down the memory hole, and I was amazed at how far-sighted these paleoconservatives had been. I don't entirely agree with them. Nevertheless, they did truly offer an alternative to National Review's conservatism. When I read Garrett Garrett right there in the office one evening, I thought, if this guy's right, what am I doing here? And, you know, in due course, I separated myself, went my own way. And I'm determined never to run with a pack again. That was an awful thing.
It's really interesting, too, to go back and read that history of how really Buckley, and this was before your time at National Review, so I'm not blaming you, but the National Review crowd really did everything in the world that they could to smear everyone else out of the conservative movement.
Yep.
If you were a Bircher or a Libertarian or a Randian Objectivist or anything like that, they basically did everything they could to call you a Nazi and just
right.
Kick you completely out of the movement, right?
That's right. Or a nut. That unfortunately tends to be Bill's strong card. Whenever he breaks with somebody, he tends to portray the guy as a nut. And with Gary Wills, with his brother-in-law Brent Bozell, with me, and a lot of other people, most of whose names you might not recognize, but it's an old habit of his.
I wonder if there's really such a thing as conservatism anymore. You have paleoconservatism, and like you say, Jonah Goldberg and all the neocons at the National Review now. Who's just a plain old conservative without a hyphen anymore?
Yeah, and after all, everybody wants to conserve something. Liberals want to conserve their gains. They're afraid of even Clarence Thomas. They're afraid he'll actually start reading the Constitution back into the Constitution.
Yeah, right.
As I always say, at present, the U.S. Constitution poses no serious threat to our form of government.
Yeah, you got that right. Unfortunately, seems like you really nailed that one.
Yeah, they just ignore the Constitution. The simplest proof of that is whenever somebody proposes a new law, for example, the Clinton's health care plan, you get a lot of conservatives saying, well, how are we going to pay for it? But you don't find people asking, even conservatives asking, where does the Constitution authorize a thing like this?
Oh, we're way past that point now, aren't we? All right, everybody, hang tight. We'll be right back with Joe Sobrin on the Weekend Interview Show.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest this hour is Joe Sobrin. And Joe Sobrin once wrote that if you're for violence against your neighbors, you're a liberal. If you're for violence against foreigners overseas, then you're a conservative. If you're for violence against everyone, you're a moderate. And if you're for violence against nobody, that makes you an extremist. And I like that so much, I put it on a bumper sticker.
And thank you, Scott. I appreciate that.
I love that. I love that bit. In fact, I'm looking at your website right now. It says, has a little glossary here, anti-Semite, a person who's hated by Jews. bigot, one who practices sociology without a license, bribe, an irregular transaction through which the citizen may get his money's worth of service from the government. I love it, man. There's a whole bunch of bumper stickers right here.
Oh, good. Glad you like them.
And you wrote a book called Anything Called a Program is Unconstitutional.
Hey, you don't find the word program in the Constitution. You know, all government really is the institutionalization of covetousness. We're not supposed to covet our neighbor's property, but that's exactly what government does. It's not that some nice person decides we need services and then, having set up a government to provide them, decides we also have to have taxes to pay for them. They start by wanting your wealth. That's why if you read history carefully, you keep running across words like tax, levy, impost, tribute, and so forth. There's a very good book about the history of taxation by Charles Adams called For Good and For Evil.
Charles Adams, is he the same one that wrote When in the Course of Human Events,
yes,
Arguing the Case for Southern Secession?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he contends that the Northern desire for Southern revenues was the main reason for the war. I don't know about that. I think slavery played a large part in it, too. But still, there's no question that the North, that the U.S. government dreaded losing revenues from the South.
In fact, that's what Fort Sumter was, right? A federal tax collection post.
Exactly, right. That was the Pearl Harbor of its day, because the North lost its head as soon as South fired on Sumter. And it's a pretty fishy episode, because it looks as if Lincoln maneuvered the South into doing that. It was a dumb thing to do, I'm afraid. They were under tremendous pressure, I'll say that, but nevertheless, if it hadn't happened, we could have been spared that war. I don't think Lincoln could have found support for it. That's another thing we don't hear about. In the North, there was an awful lot of sympathy for secession, because it was the right of Northern states as well, of all states. But as soon as the South tried to secede and resorted to violence, the North went crazy, and the war was on for sure. And it's had such enduringly bad consequences, because the chief result of it was that the U.S. government could do anything. It was the 800-pound gorilla, and it didn't have to abide by the Constitution anymore.
Well, and this was the time that United States became United States is.
Right. And, limits on the federal government became kind of meaningless. The Republican Party was a big government party. It was not limited government, as, Calvin Coolidge and Barry Goldwater might lead you to, and Reagan might lead you to think with their rhetoric. It was definitely a party of expanding government and increasing its power. And that's what it went on to do after the war.
If I change the subject here a little bit, Joe, I want to call a truce in the culture war and let the market decide. Because, seriously, if you think about it, all the arguments about race, sexuality, marriage rights, propaganda in schools, religious versus secular, all those things really don't have a place in the policy debate, except for the fact that government intervenes in these subjects in the first place. So
right.
It seems to me that what's really important right now is war and liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we keep getting stuck on the abortion issue or prayer in schools versus gay propaganda in schools or whatever, all these social issues that divide us, we're never going to be able to stop the war, and we're going to end up having no America left to fight over at all.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see the Union really dissolve into distinct, free, and independent states, for openers. That's what Jefferson said they were, free and independent states, which means they were sovereign. They were a voluntary federation, but a state, in the true sense of the word, can always withdraw from a voluntary federation, and that's what the South thought it was doing. And the North, of course, begged to differ. And, you know, the country has never regained its focus since then. Now we get these rather inane disputes about values. What does that mean? Mean anything, everything, somebody's value, right?
Sure.
Communism is a value. The commies. I just don't see the point of, I mean, we can argue individual issues, but most of these are not the federal government's proper concern under the Constitution.
So if we have, say, an Articles of Confederation type structure, or even if we actually went by the U.S. Constitution, then what you're saying basically is we can have our culture wars within our sovereign independent state and just leave the national government out of it.
Yeah, these things didn't happen in the old days when the Constitution still meant something. You know, James Buchanan, Lincoln's predecessor, said the states had no right to secede, but the federal government had no power to prevent them from seceding. So, you know, that's a tenable position, I suppose, except that, as I say, the very definition of a state is something that can secede.
Sure. Well, and then, I don't know about all, but the vast majority of the state conventions that ratified the Constitution said in their ratification that they reserved the right to secede at any time.
Well, I think only three of them actually said that, but the very fact that their ratifications were accepted as valid meant that, of course, a state has the right to secede, not just these three. But if these three did, they all did, Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York. Odd to think of New York seceding, although what goes around comes around, as they say, and now the blue states are mumbling or grumbling about secession a little bit.
And you think it's a good idea to just let them go?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, what about the red state voters in the blue states?
What about what?
What about the 49% of the people in the blue states who voted red?
Well, they just have to live with it, I guess.
Well, you know, I agree with you. I'm all for the Articles of Confederation, if not just complete market anarchy, because I see the Constitution of 1789 as a coup d'etat, which, you know, has led to, as we've been discussing, a permanent state of warfare pretty much ever since then. And I don't know. Actually, I was a little bit hopeful reading today's column that you wrote, or maybe it was yesterday's, but your latest column where you say that don't worry about the American Empire because we're going to go bankrupt before we go take over the whole world. And
yeah, I think that's very likely.
The dollar seems like it's having a lot of trouble right now, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't understand these things very well, but my gosh, they've run up such a colossal debt that every American child is $100,000 or so in debt as soon as he comes out of the womb. So, going to tell him he has self-government? And these debts have been imposed on him before he was even conceived? Ridiculous. But
well,
that's what we've come to.
If I may attempt, which this is not going to be, you know, very good because I don't believe this for a minute, but I'm trying to play devil's advocate here and justify the American Empire by saying that, you know, they call the empire, they call it free markets and democracy. That's what they really want to do is export the American and or British way of life to everybody else on Earth and force them to accept it. But they point out that there are now fewer dictatorships on Earth than ever before. And,
yeah,
of course, all praise due to the USA.
Yeah. Well, if you mean simple strongman dictatorships, yeah, they're disappearing. But we have other things, don't we? We have bureaucracies. Look, does any elected official come to your door to offer his services? Now, if a government agent comes to your door, it's someone you've never heard of and certainly didn't elect. He's got a gun. If he's a cop, it's on his hip. If he's not a cop, it's back in the office. The government is so colossal. This reaches into every pore of American life now. That it's ridiculous to call this self-government. It's just a matter, of who the figurehead is going to be for the next few years. It doesn't make much difference whether Bush or Kerry wins. They're pretty much the same. They agree on nearly everything. And this is what, Chesterton said, men can always be blind to a thing so long as it's big enough. And men now are blind to the total politicization of society. There's nothing outside the government scope.
Which is what makes us fight over all these things that really aren't worth fighting over.
Right.
I remember Jefferson wrote that he cares not whether his neighbor has one god or 1,000 gods because it neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg.
And I care, but I'm not going to try to unite the church and the state. The best solution to the church-state problem is to get rid of the state.
There you go. Same thing with the schools, right? You have people fighting whether to force prayer in school or whether to force secular humanist propaganda in school. Hey, let's just abolish government school, and then you can send your kid to whatever kind of propaganda machine you want.
Right, or none.
Or none.
Yeah, blasphemous thought. Because Americans believe in education, and it's one of the strange features of American life that we accept the principle of communism when it comes to schools. And the, if you send your kid to a private school, you still have to pay for the public schools, too. You can send him to a Muslim school if you want, but you still have to pay for the atheist school, government school.
Right. Well, I think with the Bush reelection, there's really quite a few opportunities here for realignment. And that's what my community college history teacher called it, when everybody's opinion changed and the whole paradigm just completely fell apart. And I think this whole left-right thing is pretty much dead. And I think it's time for the American people to start seeing themselves in two major camps, those who worship the state and those who worship liberty and detest the state's infringement on that liberty. And I think if we can rearrange the left-right spectrum into an up-down spectrum and have liberty on one end and slavery on the other, I think a lot of the, like we're discussing, the social issues that divide us sort of become moot. Because as long as that other person's point of view isn't being legislated against you, what do you really care?
Mm.
And I've noticed, in fact, there's a case right now before the Supreme Court about medical marijuana and federalism, which is forcing left-wingers all across America to re-examine Article 1, Section 8. And think that, maybe federalism isn't such a bad idea after all.
Yeah.
Maybe if they want to keep pot illegal in Alabama, they can, but if we want to legalize it in California, we can.
It's funny how losing power tends to shake people's philosophies up a little, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, they used to assume that the megastate was on their side and always would be. Now they're finding, there's a new book by a couple of British observers from The Economist, arguing that Bush has indeed created a new kind of conservatism, a big government conservatism. And suddenly a lot of liberals are discovering the virtues of limited government. I wonder if they'll go all the way and discover anarchism. We can dream, can't we?
It would be nice, although the left version of anarchism, I don't know. I've known some left anarchists, and it sounds pretty much just like communism to me. It's not quite the Rothbardian, Hoppian school.
No, not at all.
But it's better than being a communist. I mean, outright, workers of the world create a dictatorship and that kind of Marxist stuff.
Right.
I'll tell you, Joe, I had a conversation long ago with a left-wing anarchist. This was back when I was still a constitutionalist. And I was explaining to this guy that, listen, socialism with a police force is communism.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay, fine, but capitalism with a police force is fascism. And I went, dope! You got me there, pal. Because actually isn't that exactly the case. If you have capitalism, as long as you have a nation state as well, the people who are already rich are going to hire that nation state to protect them from everybody else.
Well, I don't know. The word fascist is used so loosely without much definition.
I use it pretty much interchangeably with mercantilism, where the state and the private interests don't abolish each other. They work together.
Well, yeah, that can happen, but there are other things, too. I mean, for example, we now keep hearing this word Islamofascism to refer to the enemy in the war on terrorism. But these Islamists aren't particularly statist. The idea that they want a sort of business government collusion is pretty unrealistic.
Right, yeah, I think that's a pretty ridiculous
thing. What their final goal would be, I don't even know if they have one. They just right now want to drive the U.S. out of their part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if they were tremendously successful at that and could somehow impossibly consolidate all power in the region, they might try to export their theocratic ways outside of the region, but I can't imagine that would be something they'd be able to do anytime soon. All right, we're talking with Joe Sobrin. He writes at Sobrin.com. You should look him up. We'll be right back after this break to wrap up the show, this interview anyway. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and we're wrapping up with Joe Sobrin. You not only could, but should read what he writes at Sobrin.com. He's really one of the leading lights in this new movement to basically revive the old right. He's, I don't know if you'd call yourself a paleo-libertarian or paleo-conservative or somewhere in there in the liberty-loving old right.
Theo-anarchist.
Neo-anarchist. There you go.
Theo.
Oh, what?
Theo-anarchist.
Oh, Theo-anarchist.
Right. I believe that if we get rid of the states, society will be organized around the churches, which is as it should be. They'll exert moral authority, and they'll have no enforcement powers except ostracism, which is also as it should be.
Yeah, prefer mores to legislation, is that right?
Right. Values galore.
Well, I sure appreciate that, and I'm glad that people get a chance to know that you don't have to be a communist to be against this war, or the next one, for that matter.
No. You know, Marx rooted for the North in the Civil War.
Of course
he
did.
So it was more progressive than the South. South was feudal and the North was capitalist, and that was the next stage of development on the way to socialism and communism. He was a newspaper correspondent in New York during the war.
Let's see. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you about. I thought this was funny. I was Googling your name to prepare for the show, and I found that there's a lot of racists out there who really don't like you because you're so politically correct.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. I hate to disappoint them, but, you know, if you want to be a racist, then first thing you should notice is the white race seems to be destroying itself. Look at the population numbers.
Yeah, well, and destroying everybody else, too.
Yeah, well, we'll get them all. I mean, this is, I can't see getting so indignant about the immigrants, for example. They're just behaving naturally. They're having kids and trying to improve their lot. Why don't we do that?
Because we're too busy trying to run everybody else's, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. So, the West is not even reproducing, not even maintaining, replacement, not even achieving replacement levels. Whose fault is that?
Well, you know, I think what tends to happen is when societies become rich and prosperous, people tend to only have one or two children and invest a lot in the raising of those one or two children instead of having 10 and hoping they get lucky.
Yeah, well, that's just unhealthy. I mean, it's morbid. What would you rather have, a child or a new car? Gosh, I don't know which of my kids I would have traded for a new car. I've got four. And if I'd gotten a new car instead of one of them, that car would have been on the junk heap many years ago. I wouldn't have the kid. I like the kid.
All right, everybody. Joseph Sobrin. He has a newsletter, a monthly newsletter called Sobrins, and you can read everything he writes at Sobrin.com. I want to thank you very much for joining me on the show today, sir.
Thank you, Scott, for having me.
I hope we can talk again soon.
Love to.
All right. Take good care. All right, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Temporary Limited Constitutional Republic Broadcasting Network, and we will be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.